Welcome, everyone. I'm the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm a Wing Chun instructor and martial arts fanatic based here in New York City. I'm one half of the duo that was Dudes of Kung Fu with my late buddy, Big Sean Madigan. I love dispelling myths about Chinese martial arts, especially Wing Chun, and talking Kung Fu and old stories. If you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast on whatever platform you're using to listen to us. For those of you who are watching us on YouTube, of course, if you like what I do here, please don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius and hit that bell for notifications. Smash that like button and share and comment and help us get the word out there. And with that, let's get started.
Okay, peeps, on today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the Genius and I will be talking to Matt Polly. He is the author of Bruce Lee, A Life, the best cradle to the grave biography on Bruce Lee. He's also the author of American Shaolin, where he talks about his training at the Shaolin Temple, and Tapped Out, where he's had a real MMA fight in Vegas. Okay? Lots of gems, lots of stories, lots of Bruce Lee. Let's get to it!
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practice all day like a genius.
So super excited here with Matthew Polly, a good friend of mine who's written the best book on Bruce Lee, hands down. I know this because I've read every single one of them. Bruce Lee, A Life is a well over 600-page biography of Bruce Lee that all Bruce Lee fans have waited pretty much their entire lives to read. Like I said, I've read every single book there is about Bruce Lee, and this is by far the best, the most complete, and the only one that's really written without any kind of spin. It's kind of like the old Dragnet, just the facts. And I just want to say before I formally introduce Matt Polly, I want to tell the story about how I met him, which was at Angela Mao's restaurant in Flushing. I was there. Rick Myers was there. And I remember Rick Myers comes up to me and he goes, hey, that's Matthew Polly over there. And he just wrote a book about Bruce Lee. And I didn't know off the top of my head who Matt Polly was. And I was like, another one? Like, at first I was just kind of like, great, another Bruce Lee book, because that's what we've waiting for, right? But then he said he's the guy who wrote American Shaolin. And I was like,
already read that book.
Yeah, that book's amazing.
What about Tapped Out?
At that time I had not read it. I didn't even know Tapped Out existed.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so then I was like, okay, and then that's basically I had the chance to talk to Matthew, and then it's been pretty cool ever since. So hey, Matthew, great to see you again, man.
Hey, brother, it's great to be on. Thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, it's been far too long. Before we talk about Bruce Lee, A Life, and all that, I want to actually talk real quick about your first book, American Shaolin, which I've recently been revisiting in the audiobook version, which is great. I don't know who read it, but he reminds me very much of you. He's really great. One of our YouTube subscribers named Evan, he wanted to know, and I also wanted to know the answer to this. You mentioned that before you went to Shaolin, and for our listeners, so you basically wrote a book about your experience going to the Shaolin Temple in the very early 90s and training there. But before you went to the Shaolin Temple, you said that you had trained in some kind of Kung Fu for like 2 or 3 years. And YouTube subscriber, Evan, and I also want to know, what kind of Kung Fu was that you did before you went to Shaolin?
So my entire martial arts experience was like freshman year of college. I took a semester of Taekwondo, and then I did a semester of Aikido, because Steven Seagal. And then you realize it was nothing like Steven Seagal's Aikido.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And then I had a friend who had a master in Albany who taught what was called a Southern Kung Fu. But he was one of those, and you and I are about the same generation, so you know they're the ex-Vietnam vets who taught martial arts when they came back. And they were all slightly unstable men for various good reasons.
Sure, sure, sure.
And looking back on what he taught me, I have no idea what that was. Uh-huh. It was some of the moves clearly were Kung Fu related. But I think it was probably one of those guys who had an amalgam of things that he called.
Right. A lot of neck snapping and ripping heads and spines out of people's
That's
back.
Right. You know, punji sticks and, yeah.
You also, so one of the things is that I'm actually listening to the audiobook again, and I just got past the part where you talked about, you had gone there and you'd started, first of all, you were kind of shocked that China and the Shaolin Temple, especially in like the early 90s era of mainland China, was not exactly what you had expected it to be. And one of the things that you were kind of lamenting is that, like, the spiritual side, which you thought perhaps mostly because of movies and things like the Kung Fu TV series, wasn't really there until you started to kind of push. And then you talked about having like this epiphany there in that moment where you just, it all came there. And as quickly as you had that real experience that a lot of people are looking for, where you were kind of like outside of yourself for a moment, you snap back right away. And I was curious, since then, have you ever revisited that experience? Is that something that you still think about? Is that something that you come back to? Or was that kind of like a one and done?
I definitely revisit that experience in my mind, because part of the reason I went there, and I think a lot of people get into martial arts, is not just the physical, but also the kind of spiritual component. And so I was very much sort of a young questing, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance type of guy.
Right.
And when I had that experience, when it was over, I had this feeling like that was it. Like in this life, the universe was going to open up once,
right,
and say, there's something more. And the next life, maybe you're going to get it, but you're done now.
that was your one and done, right?
Yeah, it was. It felt like the one and done. It felt like, here's the answer. There's more.
How old were you at this time?
I was like 19.
And I saw some photos of you back then. You looked quite different at that time. It's cool.
I was like half the man I am now.
So also your next book, which is Tapped Out, I found out later after I met you that you wrote it. And basically this was another one of your kind of amazing journeys, but this time you decided to go into the world of MMA and actually train and then do an MMA fight. And the last time I saw you in the before times, the pre-pandemic times, you showed me the video on YouTube where you actually had your fight, which is amazing. As you went out there, you did your thing. And for our audience, if you guys haven't had a chance to watch it, you should go on YouTube and then look up Matt Pauly MMA fight. One of our subscribers, Evan, wanted to know if you had any John Donaher or Phil Nurse stories that didn't make the cut of Tapped Out.
I actually had a couple stories Donaher made me pull.
Oh, really? Really? Interesting. By the way, did you hear that John Donaher just recently moved to Puerto Rico now? He's left New York, and now he's teaching jiu-jitsu in Puerto Rico with, like, he's got his own little community there. And wow. So he's kind of ascending to the mountains, I suppose, if that's what you can call moving to Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I don't know if San Juan is my idea of the mountains, but... yeah, I mean, they both were great guys. Donaher, the one thing he asked me to pull, which I think is funny now, and I can tell since he's moved out of New York, was he made a joke about Henzo Gracie's training schedule, okay, which is that Henzo Gracie doesn't train. Because, it's hard to understand, but they grew up as kids learning this from babyhood. And so I think, it's like if your dad was a basketball coach, you'd be great at basketball, but at 18, you'd be kind of sick of it.
Right.
And so I think Donaher, who works so hard at jiu-jitsu, would tease Henzo about the fact that Henzo was so naturally talented, but never put in the hours.
Sure.
And he made a joke about it, which was funny. And I put it in the book and I let him read the manuscript because he's a great guy. And he said, I know I said this, but can you take it out? He's going to be real. I don't want my boss mad at me. And I figured
yes.
Very, despite very, being a very, very good joke, it was it wasn't necessary to the plot, so I took it out for it.
Sure. Yeah, I think the current generation maybe they don't understand that first generation of Gracies. I mean, they basically grew up with that stuff, so that's very right. Different than people who came to it later. Now back to Bruce Lee. So we all have our like how I found out about Bruce Lee story, like how we all first saw him or got exposed or whatever. So what is Matt Pauly's how I found out about Bruce Lee story?
Since I've told it before, I've now discovered this is like an archetype. But basically, I was like 12 years old, and in our town, in a small town in Kansas, a friend of mine got the first VCR machine. And we all went to his basement to watch this thing that would play movies on your TV, which was shocking at the time. And his older brother brought down a VHS tape and he said, you know, you little dudes have to see this. And it turned out to be Enter the Dragon. And, you know, in the mid 80s in Kansas, we didn't know who Bruce Lee was. We didn't know what Kung Fu movies were. And as you remember from the time, action choreography was pretty limited. So watching Bruce Lee do his thing and that being the first example sort of blew our little minds. And since I was the kind of scrawny, skinny, picked on kid, I immediately wanted to be Bruce Lee. I wanted to be as tough and powerful and as badass as Bruce Lee was. And that inspired, you know, like all of the Bruce Lee fans, you buy the nunchucks, you crack yourself in the skull, you go to some small dojo and you try to learn martial arts. And so it really set me on my sort of journey to become who I was. And then that's why sort of, I mean, you know, he really is a patron saint of Kung Fu. And in my case, he sort of shaped the whole course of my life.
So did you decide to write a book about Bruce Lee because you just felt dragging the Bruce Lee story glossed over a couple details?
just one or two. No, it's funny. What happened was I just finished Tapped Out, where I'd spent 2 years studying mixed martial arts. And in the process, you know, I got my nose broken and my ribs cracked. And so I said, the next book I'm writing, I'm not going to get punched in the face for it. So I was looking for a project that I could do that would have a broad appeal. And a friend of mine said, why don't you do a biography of Bruce Lee? And my initial response was, that's a terrible idea. There has to be a bunch of really good Bruce Lee biographies that I just don't know about. And then he said, well, why don't you do the research? And then I did. And as you know, having read them all, they're fairly thin, mostly biased, and done by people who are not that dedicated to research. Once I saw that, I actually felt sort of personally offended on behalf of my childhood hero that no one had thought the Asian martial arts expert was worthy of the kind of biographies we give to any white guy who does anything. You know, there are biographies of everybody, but Bruce Lee didn't have a proper biography. So that really was the goal, is to do the kind of biography that any major celebrity who's Caucasian has in the United States. Yeah, I would say that the key to it was the willingness to, as the Chinese say, churku, or eat bitter.
Eat bitter.
You know, the biography, I had, this is my first biography I'd ever written. And what I discovered is it's really the coal mining of publishing, because you really got to go down and just dig and dig and dig. And most of what you bring out is dirt, but every once in a while you find a little diamond.
In your research, obviously, you know, you have to start with all the books that already exist. And, you know, like you said, I've also noticed a lot of them are written from a very kind of biased perspective, but, you know, it is what it is. Did you ever read the or have access to the Bruce Lee, the Man Only I Knew, the original Linda Lee version of that book? Because I've never had a chance to read it, but I heard that the first edition of it was brutally honest. And then later they had like rewritten or re-edited it and taken a lot of the more salacious things out. And then suddenly, if you ask the Lee estate, those things never existed. But I've never actually seen it, but I heard that it kind of is a pretty perhaps one of the more honest books written about Bruce Lee.
Yeah, actually, so that's interesting. So in 1975, she wrote her first biography of her husband, Bruce Lee, The Man Only I Knew. And that was actually a response to Alex Ben Block, who wrote The Legend of Bruce Lee. So that was the first biography in 1974, and hers came out a year later, and it basically was cashing in on the Bruce Lee phenomenon. But what was interesting about it was Bruce Lee wasn't yet a phenomenon, and he had just recently died, and she wrote it from the perspective of a kind of loving wife. So there's not a lot of scandal, but it's still got like little moments where she says things like, well, he often forgot my birthday. The kind of thing a wife would tell her friends when she's reminiscing about him. And then in 1988 or 89, they were planning to make a movie out of Bruce Lee's life. And so she revised the original book. And basically the second version was her first book minus anything even remotely non-saintly about Bruce Lee. And so it was basically the whitewash version of her first book.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of that also represented a big shift in general from a lot of the official stuff, is that there definitely seems to be, especially in more recent years, this kind of Bruce Lee, the saint, and, you know, this kind of philosopher who, you know, was perfect and great at everything, which, you know, I think all of us as like old school fans of Bruce Lee, like we love him also because he was a real person who dealt with a lot of the things that everyday people deal with, but they seem to want to make him like, you know, almost unreal and like, you know, he had no flaws. And I think that, you
That's
know,
right.
maybe not the way to go. When you started doing the research for Bruce Lee Alive, and I mean, like when you started actually doing the interviews and really getting into it, was there anyone that you interviewed that you maybe on before you interviewed them, you thought they were just going to give you some pro forma answers or nothing special, and they ended up exceeding your expectations, or they told you something that you didn't imagine? Was there anyone who kind of surprised you in terms of what they told you?
That's an interesting question. Like I can't think of one person who kind of blew me away. But each one kind of added little details that weren't there before. And so kind of cumulatively, the effect was that you got a clearer and clearer picture. I do have to say early on, I thought Fred Weintraub, who produced Enter the Dragon, was particularly useful, partly because he's a really good storyteller, but also partly because he has mixed feelings about Bruce. And I thought that was useful because Bruce was in his own life. You could tell he was kind of he was a definitive person. And so you either loved him or you hated him.
Right.
And to find someone who had a kind of mixed view of him was rare. And so that's why I thought Fred Weintraub sort of opened some things up.
What about Andre Morgan? Was he, because I've heard interviews with him before, but of course sometimes, you know, maybe what he tells you privately in an interview might be a little bit different than what he's done there. Did he have any kind of mixed feelings about Bruce Lee, or was he like totally gung-ho?
Who's
Bruce
Andre
Lee was the
Morgan
man.
Again?
Andre Morgan used to work for Raymond Chow.
Yes.
And responsible for, you know, putting, he was basically the white guy who worked at Golden Harvest.
He was. He was like a 22-year-old kid from Kansas who could speak Mandarin. And they'd hired him as basically the intern. And then Bruce Lee came along and he became really important. Andre Morgan's great because he's just been in the business so long that he's kind of no BS. And so I like people like that who don't really have an axe to grind. But he is quite affectionate towards Bruce Lee. And so a lot of things, I had to interview him 3 or 4 times on certain topics to sort of get into it. And he's also crucial because he's one of the last people to see Bruce Lee alive. And so he was very helpful in trying to sort out that last day of Bruce Lee's life. Continues to be the one area where there's the most cover up about what exactly happened that day.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. I'm going to save that for a little bit later. No interview with Matt Pauly would be complete without discussing that whole thing. Yes. But before we get there, actually, another one of our YouTube subscribers, Brooks Long, wanted to know, did you do any Wing Chun or Jeet Kune Do training while researching Bruce Lee?
Yeah, so when I interviewed Dan Inosanto, one of his senior students gave me a class on both Wing Chun and Jeet Kune Do. Right before I did the interview, I did this class, and so I got some of the basics. You know, it was good to feel it out. And I had to decide whether I wanted to spend a lot of time invested in that. And I, from my own martial arts experience, I kind of got the basics of it. I understood what the principles were.
Right.
And didn't feel that was necessary to the overall story.
And so when you finished the book, and so you had amassed all this data, you had all this research, and you started putting it together, did you have a different impression of Bruce Lee than when you started? You know, at the end, did you look at him differently, or was it just a little more clear? Or did you have any, was there any journey for you from before starting the project to completing it?
I think the biggest difference was there was a paradigm shift in how I understood him as a person. And the biggest difference was, like everybody who came to Bruce Lee through his movies and pop culture and Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, I thought of him primarily as a martial artist who kind of accidentally got into movies. And when I the big experience was when I went to Hong Kong to the Hong Kong Film Archives and spent like 2 weeks watching all the childhood movies he made, the 20 Cantonese films. And after the third or fourth, I was like, ah, this is Macaulay Culkin. If Macaulay Culkin had taken up martial arts and then reinvented himself as sort of Rambo or Jason Statham, that would be Bruce Lee's career. He was a scrappy orphan kid in comedies and melodramas. He was an actor. And I know enough about actors to know they tend to be people who get obsessed by something.
Sure.
And so he was an actor who got obsessed by the martial arts and then merged those two things together. And so if you understand him primarily as an actor first and a martial artist second, his career makes more sense. But I think the myth is because the martial arts is more interesting, they elevate that first. And then when you're trying to tell his story, then you edit out things that don't fit into the archetype of the mystical martial arts master. He made a bunch of films. None of them were kung fu films. And he was like most childhood actors, he was a pain in the ass who got into trouble. He was like Justin Timberlake, you know, childhood stars. And so the martial arts was really a kind of personal outgrowth that he managed to merge in with his acting career.
Now, what I also like about your book is that it's very even-handed in terms of his entire life. Whereas obviously most of the books that are written about Bruce Lee, they either focus on aspects of his martial arts training or perhaps just his films. But since it's a full biography, you talk about his background, his childhood, his parents, all this kind of stuff, his martial arts training, everything. And I'm always curious because obviously most martial arts people are very biased. Within Wing Chun, it's kind of split. There are people who love him because he's our great hero and one of the reasons why Wing Chun is famous. And yet there are a bunch of other Wing Chun people. Oh, he never learned the whole system, blah, 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 blah. And of course, then you have people who are very split in terms of what his relationship with Grandmaster Yip Man was, especially in the 60s, once he had coined the phrase Jeet Kune Do and had kind of done his own thing. There's, you know, obviously a lot of speculation that their relationship was strained. And this is something that you talk about in a very even-handed way. Everyone knows pretty much if a Wing Chun person tells me what their opinion of Bruce Lee is, I can guess what lineage they belong to because you got haters and you got people who really like him. So as someone who's kind of coming from the outside, what can you say perhaps about Bruce Lee and Yip Man's relationship, let's say, in the early 70s, once Bruce Lee started to become famous, once he had already broken away and created his own style, what kind of things did you find out or what kind of things did you find out that were interesting about that?
I mean, I think the key to understanding that is that the rivalry was really amongst Yip Man's students, of which Bruce Lee was one. And so I think a lot of any bad feelings comes from one of the students. As far as I could tell, Ip Man was delighted that one of his students was the most famous person in Hong Kong.
Sure, sure. Like,
and I think there probably was some, you know, why did he have to go form his own style? Why Bruce Lee was saying publicly, like, traditional styles are, you know, the classical mess. And so he was critical, essentially, of his mother's style. And that's what his Ip Man students were reacting to. But they did have a meeting where they sat down and had some yum cha and talked it out. And so I think it was pretty clear that Ip Man was a man of a certain age who recognized that having China's most famous martial artist be his disciple was good for him. And clearly from the half a dozen or so Ip Man movies that now exist in the world, it was great for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're all very grateful. I don't care if it's Ip Man 9 in space. Yeah. Let them bring all those films out. I'm more than happy. It's great for business. There also was a lawsuit at the time. I don't know. You mentioned it in your book, something about Yip Chun, the son of Yip Man, had said something about Bruce Lee, and then Bruce Lee was going to sue him in the paper. And then, after his death, obviously that was his own. Can you talk a little bit about that real quick?
Oh yeah, so that's a funny story. So Bruce Lee initially, like most celebrities, don't realize that the press builds you up for the purpose of later tearing you down. That's the only two stories they tell, which is like, whoa, this amazing new thing. And oh, this jaded jerk who doesn't care about anything but himself. And so his ascent was so rapid in the first year in Hong Kong that within like 18 months, the press had turned on him. And so they started looking for stories to talk about what was negative about him. And they got to Yip Chun, who said something, because the Wing Chun students were annoyed at Bruce Lee for starting his own style, Yip Chun talked a little smack on Bruce.
Right.
And basically saying he wasn't that good as a teenager in Wing Chun, which, to be fair, is probably true, because as you and I have discussed privately, Bruce didn't start studying. I don't think he started studying Wing Chun until he was 16. So by the time he left at 18 or 19 for America, he wasn't an advanced student in Wing Chun. So at any rate, Bruce read it in the newspaper, and this was like the final straw, one of his own, you know, Wing Chun brothers stabbing him in the back. So he went to Wing Chun, he went to Yip Chun and basically got in his face, and Yip Chun backed down and was like, oh, no, it was the reporter. I didn't say any of these things.
Right.
And then Bruce Lee went into the office of the newspaper and basically threatened to beat the shit out of the editor. And so at that point, they printed more stuff saying, you know, Bruce Lee, the bully star who thinks he's better than everyone. And so Bruce decided to sue them and filed a lawsuit. Andre Morgan actually said that Bruce's feeling was, if he didn't sort of draw a line somewhere, this would continue. But unfortunately, it just, the lawsuit made it worse. And once he died, Linda dropped the lawsuit because she realized there was nothing to it.
Well, it's also funny too. I can imagine Bruce would be first of all, I mean, I'm sure there's tons of people who can say, Matt Pauly, I remember him from the Shaolin Temple. He wasn't that good. Right. Meanwhile,
right.
You've gone on to win an MMA fight. Right. And so I think a lot of times people will, you know, make some statement about the person you were 20 years ago, as if somehow that's
right.
like a life sentence or whatever. But also very curious in that particular instance is that Yip Chun was not even living in Hong Kong at the time that Bruce Lee was learning from his father. I mean, Yip Chun did not come to Hong Kong until about the early to mid 60s. And Bruce had already been in the States for a number of years at that time. So the question is always, oh, well, so you saw that I wasn't too good as a teenager, but you weren't even here. How did that even
they
happen? Right.
Didn't even meet at that point. Right.
No,
I don't think they would have met until much later, but maybe had met him at
Bruce
some
Lee
point.
Came
but
at him.
Yeah.
And what you can tell, though, is they're clearly, and as you know, as a martial artist, we're all very proud and we're all petty.
And so
Yip Chun sat around with all the other Wing Chun guys, and they were like, I knew Bruce when he was 16 and he sucked and I kicked his butt.
Right.
And so Yip Chun repeated what someone had said to
sure.
him to a reporter
sure.
and then got called out and tried to get away from it because Bruce Lee was a scary dude. By the time he was 32, like, you didn't want to fight Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
So, and that was the sort of point, is that whatever he was at 17, he was a great martial artist by the time he became a star.
That brings us to another topic, which is the oft disputed timeline of when Bruce Lee started learning Wing Chun, right? And I think it's always like the standard age was, oh, he started at 13. But the joke is, if you read the biography of any Kung Fu master, they either started at 11 or 13 and they were always a sickly child. So-and-so was a sickly child who had to start learning martial arts so as to build up their strength. And I think that, and of course, Bruce Lee's mother, Grace, was in the interview saying, oh, he started at 13. But truthfully, if you ask my mom right now what age I started Wing Chun at, she would probably, she wouldn't, she's not the person to answer that question.
Okay.
So I think that I always suspected that he did not actually do Wing Chun as long as people thought he did. And that was basically the, what you came up with as well when you were looking at the timeline when he actually started versus what people say.
That's right. So he himself at the time in an interview, they asked him when you studied martial arts and he said 13. And as a martial artist myself, as you, whenever you ask somebody how long they've trained, they always add 5 to 10 years. No one ever goes, well, actually it's been 3.5 weeks. They're
right.
Like, oh, it's been 18 years. And I started when
and
I was
weeks.
In the womb.
Right.
So initially I was suspicious anyway. And then I found out, you know, the storyline from Hawking's Chung is that Bruce Lee started Wing Chun after he went to St. Francis Xavier. He was kicked out of LaSalle and went to St. Francis Xavier. And then I looked at the chronology and I was like, well, when did he enter St. Francis Xavier? And it was like, well, when he was 16. So that's when he started. St. Francis Xavier was actually fairly close to Yip Man's school. So he could go from school to there, and LaSalle was on the other side of town. So all of those things pointed to the fact that the experience that he met the right William Chung and all these people after he switched schools. And right. He switched schools at this age, and we know it because we have the records. So yes. It doesn't matter what Bruce Lee told an interviewer.
Right.
What matters is, like, do those fit together? So he did practice some martial arts with his father, some Tai Chi, and, you know, like kids walking around watching, you know, Power Rangers. I'm sure he threw kicks and did stuff because he lived in the culture. But his formal training in Wing Chun, I'm 99% certain, occurred after he switched schools, and at that age he was 15 and a half to 16.
Right. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense too, given what we know that he knows that he had actually learned in Wing Chun versus what he had not learned right. Yet, that the timeline seems to fit. And also Wing Chun, you don't need to know the whole style to be able to fight with it, which is one of the selling points of it.
That's right.
Yeah. So moving ahead to the future here. So, you mentioned, I remember you mentioned on another interview, you talk about in the book, the reason why Chuck Norris only wanted to do the one film with Bruce Lee, which because Chuck Norris loses, and Chuck Norris didn't like losing, and he would have to lose to Bruce Lee. So he basically said, okay, I'll do this one film, but I'm not going to do it again. And after that, it seemed that then Bob Wall became kind of the guy to get sloshed around by Bruce. But you had mentioned something about kind of Bob Wall basically inviting himself to Way of the Dragon. And it, like, get curious about this story.
Yeah. So Bruce Lee hired or called up Chuck Norris, who was a friend of his, and they had trained together. Chuck, of course, was the best karate point fighter of that era. And Bruce was training all the top karate point fighters before he went to Hong Kong. And he brought Chuck in because he knew for the Chinese audience, him beating up the white all-American karate champion would be a huge crowd pleaser. And Chuck knew it too.
Right.
But, you know, Chuck wanted to break into the movie business because he lived in LA and he knew where the money was. So Chuck was business partners with Bob Wall. Which in general is a mistake, but anyway, Bob was like, well, I want to go too. So, you know, Chuck couldn't say no to Bob. So Bob bought his own ticket, and they were going to film the first scene on the air tarmac of Rome's airport with the plane landing. At that point, there was no security and you could bribe officials. So they essentially filmed Chuck walking off the airplane that he flew in on. And so it was a shock to Bruce when Bob followed behind him.
Oh, geez. Bruce had met Bob Wall before, right?
And so he knew who Bob Wall was. And I'm sure because it was a very small community at that time. I mean, if you were into martial arts, there were like five of you, right?
Right.
And so the LA scene. So I'm sure he knew who Bob Wall was. And since, you know, since Bruce died, Bob Wall's made a real career out of being Bruce Lee's friend. And so that means that a lot of people love to tell some version of the story that Bruce Lee didn't really like Bob Wall or wasn't happy when he showed up. And Bob Wall vociferously denies this and physically threatens anybody who says it.
Sorry, what was the business that Bob Wall was in when this was going on?
So Bob was like, so basically the business they were in were running a bunch of martial arts schools. But Bob has always been a kind of real estate. He's like a kind of mini Trump. He was kind of a real estate business guy.
He got in trouble for a bit, didn't he? Like, didn't he not? I don't know. He got in some legal trouble, I remember, at some point.
Yeah, he got convicted of committing business fraud and sentenced to 2 years in jail. But, you know, real estate guys in the 70s, you know, maybe it's not that unusual. But at any rate, Bob was a bit of a business hustler. And he was also a pretty good martial artist, not quite at Chuck's level, but just a level below him. And so, you know, Chuck went to Bruce and said, hey, can you get my buddy into the film? And Bruce thought about it and figured out a way to stick him in the end of Way of the Dragon. And then when Enter the Dragon came up, he went to Chuck and said, I want you in this movie. And Chuck said, I don't want to be the bad guy who loses to you again. And Bruce said, well, if you don't do it, I'm going to give it to Bob, trying to kind of leverage Bruce, trying to leverage Chuck. And Chuck was like, yeah, I think Bob will do a great job.
Yeah, and he actually did. I actually can't really imagine Chuck being in that O'Hara role. It's kind of, Bob Wall is perfect. Like, you know, he's not always perfect, but he was perfect for that.
I absolutely agree. And whatever my personal feelings about Bob Wall, I think he was absolutely spot on as O'Hara in Enter the Dragon.
And also I've heard, and I don't know if you agree with this, but Joe Louis, the late Joe Louis, who was also a champion at that time who had been training with Bruce Lee, had kind of, you know, had trained with Bruce Lee, and then they had kind of like a bit of a falling out. And I always heard that Bruce giving that role to Chuck Norris was a bit of a snub for Joe Louis. Do you feel that that was that way, or do you know, or had you heard anything in that?
So again, that's one of those interesting, like that inner circle world where they're all arguing about this. The best I could piece out was Joe says he offered it to him and he turned it down. But Joe Louis liked to tell a lot of stories. And basically, as far as I can tell, he never considered Joe Louis for the part. He always wanted Chuck, and Joe Louis realized, I think at the time he didn't know, but afterwards realized, oh, my life would be completely different. I would have Chuck Norris money. Right. I wouldn't have like the guy who goes around at seminars coaching money.
Right.
And so he was always a little bitter about that and inflated his importance. But yes, the two of them had a falling out, which was one of these like weird stories that I love about doing biographies. The story was Joe Louis's wife was extremely jealous of all of Joe Louis's friends, and she would do things to try to separate him from his friends. And so she told Joe Louis that Bruce had hit on her. And Joe went and confronted Bruce Lee. And you can just imagine what that fight would have been.
That would have been spectacular
because Joe Louis was a really good fighter.
And
Bruce was just like, had that, you know, innocent expression, like, what are you talking about? That moment, Louis realized his wife had done this, something she'd done before, which was try to separate him from his friends. Anyway, they got divorced. But Bruce never really forgave.
Damage was done at that point.
Yeah.
Interesting. So now, you know, before we get into the details and the theories about Bruce Lee's death, I just want to, you know, obviously Bruce Lee is an iconic person. So he dies at the height of his physical prowess at 32. Nobody really feels that this is something that should happen. I mean, he's very young and, you know, right at the door of his big success with Enter the Dragon. I think part of the reason why people just don't accept the official story, whether it's actually true or not, is that it seems kind of deeply unsatisfying to be the death of someone so great as Bruce Lee. What is your opinion about why there's in general, not like the details, but why in general there's so much pushback about how Bruce Lee died?
So I think you hit on the main point, which is he was 32, he was the height of his powers, and he dies a month before his movie comes out. So his movie image, his movie character, Bruce Lee, the Kung Fu master, immediately merges with whoever that person was and it consumes it. And so his life has to be like the movie. And it can't be that he took an aspirin and died from it.
Exactly.
It has to be ninjas or the triads, or, you know, it has to be something that's truly Kung Fu revenge movie worthiness. And I think that's the ultimate physical sort of impulse of it. And then I think also the fact that he dies in Hong Kong, which seems like a mysterious place at that time, adds any sort of intrigue you want to throw in. So, you know, you would read stories from people who should have known better saying, well, you know, the Chinese are masters of poison.
Right, exactly.
You're like, really? Really? Like, is that their special skill, poison? So, you know, these kind of Orientalism bigotries of that era come out. And so Bruce Lee is involved in something murky, and it makes sense because it's far away and you can add these stories and it all adds up. Primarily, it's what you said, is Bruce Lee, a man that great, who is this great icon, has to have a noble death.
And of course, before we get into your, your theory and what you came up with, I still want to push on some of the conspiracies because,
yes,
I mean, as Bruce Lee, like, first of all, you know, sometimes you talk about Bruce Lee's death and people will be like, oh, why do you focus on that? You should focus on what he did and his achievements. It's like, well, I teach martial arts. 9 times out of 10, when I talk about Bruce Lee, I'm talking about his amazing achievements and the things he did as a martial artist. But it's still a fun thought experiment because there's only a very, very small handful of people who probably really knew definitively. Mm. And that list is getting smaller and smaller year to year. Mm. And do you remember the footage of Bruce Lee? I mean, of course, you've seen it before, where he's on the set of Enter the Dragon, Han's palace, and he's there with his teacher, Wong Sun Leung. And Wang Kam Leung is there, and they're doing like a test shot, you know, for like some. They have this guy, Joey Chen, there, and he's kind of in the Bruce Lee role doing some light sparring with Wong Sun Leung. Well, he's been on YouTube recently. And this question actually comes from Sifu David Peterson, who's one of the late Wong Sun Leung's top disciples. And I asked him before, because he's someone I respect a lot, and he's also a huge Bruce Lee fan. I said, hey, I'm going to interview Matt Pauly on Tuesday. Do you have any questions for him? And he said that the persistent rumors that Bruce Lee's death was arranged by Raymond Chow. You know, this is like something that it doesn't seem to go away. Now, I don't prescribe to it, but, and I don't, obviously David Peterson probably doesn't either, but it's just something that doesn't seem to go away. And now this Joey Chen guy who's in this footage with Bruce Lee, he was on YouTube about a year ago talking that he is like 100% certain that Raymond Chow had something to do with it. Now, why do you think, I mean, is it just low hanging fruit because he's the jealous producer, or was there anything there that, even if it's not true, why do people keep looking at Raymond Chow for this?
Well, I think it's the fact that there was only two people with Bruce Lee when he died. It was Betty Ting Pei or Raymond Chow. So if you think he was killed, it's one of those two or both, right? And so if you start from the premise that he was murdered and it's a cover up, then one of those two people have to be involved. And the somewhat ditzy actress girlfriend versus the older conniving producer.
Yeah. Right.
Who do you pick as the villain?
Yes.
I will say, you know, I'd read all those things. I also know certain of Bruce's siblings believe it was Raymond Chow.
Wow.
So it's inside the family. To this day, they believe this, although they don't want to say it publicly.
Sure.
I had the rare chance to interview Raymond Chow. It's one of the things I'm most happy I got to do. And I sat down with him and I tuned all my like violence predator sensors at him. And it's an imperfect measurement, you know, like Gaydar. I spent years tuning that sensor. And what I got from him was, this is a guy who, if you handed him $100 and asked for it back, you would get 80. But if you were like sitting there and he had a knife to your throat, he wouldn't cut. He's not, you know, there are guys who are thieves and there are guys who are killers, and he's not a killer. He just doesn't have any of that vibe. And the most important thing to understand was he was a guy running a struggling studio, and Bruce Lee was his star. And no matter what Bruce Lee did to him or offended him or whatever, this was before DVDs. Like, if your star died, you weren't making any more money. Like, you couldn't cash in on their stardom. So he was not a man who would kill his golden goose.
Sure, sure.
Under any circumstances.
And I think that some people point to the kind of weird business relationship they had towards the end there. And Bruce was paid, what, $15,000 for both Big Boss and Fist of Fury. And then for the third film, Way of the Dragon, Bruce already had a big enough star to start his own production company. Yeah. And then, you know, kind of leverage him a little bit. But it seems that, you know, I always related a little bit to like Suge Knight and Tupac, you know, when Tupac died, most of the stuff he owned was like Suge Knight actually owned it. And I think that that was the case. If I'm not mistaken, with Bruce's mansion in Kowloon Tong, that yep. was actually a Golden Harvest asset. And yep. also like even his Mercedes was Raymond Chow. So because I remember, like, you know, that Mercedes SL was like the coolest Mercedes to have, the convertible. Yeah. But I remember seeing photos of, like, now you have all these beautiful retouched digital versions of these old Bruce Lee photos. And you look at it and you're like, that Mercedes was kind of banged up already. And, like, was Bruce Lee such a bad driver that he just got this car? I mean, well, Yeah, I've heard he was a bad driver from your book, but I mean, I think like it definitely was a secondhand car by the time he got it. And I think the fact, was it true? Was at that time, because I think he owed Raymond for fronting him for his mortgage and things like that, that he was in a bit of a hole or like in a bit of a golden handcuff situation with Raymond?
Yeah, so absolutely. So it was totally the example of those like 1950s R&B stars who have the flashy Cadillac, but you know, it turns out the studio owes everything, and all when they die, all the recordings go back to this, you know, producer who owns everything. He basically, the first two films, he got paid a flat fee, $7,500, and that was just enough money to sort of take care of his debts. Way of the Dragon was the first one where he was supposedly a 50-50 profit partner with Raymond. And before that, he wanted to look like a movie star. He was the most famous guy in Hong Kong. He didn't want to live in a walk-up. So the house he had, the car he drove, the closings he had, Raymond Chow fronted all the money for that as an advance against future earnings. And by the time he died, The Way of the Dragon, as people know who worked in the movie business, that money comes in really slowly. You know, you've got box office money coming in from Singapore, Taiwan. And so Bruce was really angry with Raymond because he thought Raymond was slow walking, paying him back the money he had earned for Way of the Dragon. And I'm absolutely certain that's true.
Right.
I'm absolutely certain Raymond Chow had like three sets of books and the money was going here and there and wherever. And then every once in a while when Bruce would yell at him, he'd go, oh, here's some of it. So they were arguing over money. Bruce Lee was threatening to go to Run Run Shaw and leave Raymond. And they were making Enter the Dragon, and Bruce was looking like he might leave Hong Kong altogether and go to Hollywood. So there was a lot of tensions, but there was no rational business person at that time would have thought it was better for me as a movie producer to have my biggest star be dead than to have him still be alive. And Raymond Chow is nothing but ruthlessly Machiavellian and pragmatic. So, you know, unless the Triads had his daughter as a hostage, like you could create a scenario, but it's not one where they were angry over money.
I think that will probably be persistent for a very long time. So I like to go down these thought experiments. I think like your heat stroke hypothesis is very, very high on the list. Mm-hmm. And obviously the official version of it is also a possibility as well. But I think that if there's anything conspiratorial, and it was something like the mafia, I believe the person who would have wanted Bruce Lee dead is certainly not Raymond Chow, and I will not mention his name on this podcast. So I started saying that instead of like, what am I? I'm not going to talk about this anymore. So you have this different hypothesis about how Bruce Lee passed, which is the heat stroke hypothesis. Now, why do you think this was not something that people may have suspected early, and why do you think that this might be a possibility?
So the key to me in trying to solve what happened to Bruce Lee was the fact that he nearly died from the same thing 10 weeks earlier. And that's the key, is that he died July 20th, 1973, and May 10th, 1973, 10 weeks earlier, he was in a dubbing room that was extremely hot because they turned off the air conditioning, and he displayed all the signs of heat stroke. He got dizzy, he passed out, he vomited. They rushed him to the hospital and diagnosed him with having cerebral edema, which is swelling of the brain. And they gave him a medication to stop the swelling. And the doctor said they just barely saved his life and time. And heat stroke can cause swelling of the brain. So those were the two things I'm looking for, which is Bruce Lee died on July 20th from a swollen brain, from the autopsy. And there are only very few things that can cause swelling of the brain. It's not like a heart attack. You know, if he died of a heart attack, we would have no idea why he died. So I was looking for something that would cause cerebral edema, and heat stroke is one of the few things that will do that. And then I was looking for something that explains the previous collapse. And the previous collapse was it's pretty obviously a case of heat stroke, And then I looked at the situation on the day of, which is more complicated because everybody involved is not fully forthcoming. Betty Ting Pei or Raymond Chow on what happened that final day. But there's some indication, which is I looked at the temperature that day. It was the hottest day of the summer. You know, when Raymond Chow talked to me about what happened that day, he said Bruce Lee felt faint, that he had been demonstrating kung fu moves and gotten kind of dizzy. So it looked like a similar case to what had happened 10 weeks earlier. And heat stroke, I was also looking for something that kills young athletic men. Doing the research, 3 to 5 high school football players die a year from heat stroke to this day. Young army soldiers die from heat stroke. It's one of the things you worry about with young men who do exercise in the heat. And so it fit all the sort of criteria. Yeah. And then, of course, I looked at all the other possible theories like aspirin, asphyxia, anaphylactic shock from a allergic reaction to aspirin. And that just, for various reasons, didn't fit in. So it was a combination of feeling like this was the strongest theory and that the other theories had too many weaknesses. But again, because it's such a hot topic and people who love Bruce Lee love to argue about it, I must repeat, it's a theory. I could absolutely be wrong. we will never know why Bruce Lee died for sure. All we can do is postulate a hypothesis and test it, and then people can decide for themselves.
And that's also, I think, one of the reasons why people should read your book, too, because you have this great theory about how he passed away. But you're unlike other theories, you're not saying, well, this is it. And if you don't believe me, you're an idiot and you're completely crazy. And I think that one of my issues with the official he took, Equagesic, which is basically just an aspirin with a little muscle relaxant in it or something, and that would cause brain swelling, is that it doesn't explain the May 10th occurrence. That's because if they're so similar, and literally the difference between the two is one, he got to the hospital in time, the other one he didn't. And what is the common denominator? Well, he did not take Equagesic the first time. Mm-hmm. So I never understood how they made that jump for the second occurrence. It definitely doesn't explain it at all.
Also, didn't he have a procedure done?
Dre wants to know about the sweat glands.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So that was another sort of smoking gun, which is about 4 months before he died, or maybe 6 months. He went into a cosmetic doctor complaining about the fact that he was on screen and he had these really sweaty armpits and it was causing them to have to do reshoots and it was a real pain. And apparently at that time, they thought it was a good idea to remove people's sweat glands.
Crazy.
And I know somebody who had my age, whose mother had this surgery done. So apparently in the 70s, this was not uncommon as a cosmetic surgery. That would have reduced his ability to dissipate heat. So he has an operation that reduces his ability to dissipate heat. And then summer comes around, he collapses in a hot room. And then on the hottest day of July, he collapses and dies. That looks like heat stroke. That doesn't look like an aspirin allergy.
Right,
but,
absolutely.
You know,
I have another question from one of our listeners. This is actually one of my good friends, my friend AJ. He has his own podcast, Martial Arts Mania Podcast. He had a question for you. It's a little wordy. I'll read it. I'll read it perfect so I get it all through there. It's kind of a multi-part question. So he said, and he's a movie nerd like I am as well. Mm-hmm. He said Bruce Lee's ultimate goal was to return to America to make Hollywood pictures and be a star. And this was about to become a reality with the release of Enter the Dragon. Do you think he would have been able to thrive in a working environment where he possibly had little to no creative control, unlike in Hong Kong, where he already started to have some kind of control? And do you think he would have sacrificed his art for personal gain? Or do you think these frustrations might have led him to just go back to Hong Kong?
That's a great question. And it falls into the kind of what would have become of Bruce Lee if he had lived? And we know if he hadn't got his sweat, if my theory is right, and he hadn't got his sweat glands removed and he'd just taken a vacation that summer, he would have lived. His goal at the time, from what I heard talking to people, was he was planning to do 2 movies a year, one in Hollywood and one in Hong Kong, one to keep his base happy in Hong Kong, and also so he could do whatever he wanted personally in Hong Kong. and also to advance his career in Hollywood. And, you know, the way I think about it is he would have been extraordinarily frustrated in Hollywood because they would have, you know, tried to control him. And so I think eventually he would have tried to be like Clint Eastwood, you know, an actor, star, director, and taken over things. And it's tragic because I think he would have done a lot of he would have brought a lot of interesting Chinese influences into Hollywood at a much earlier stage. And he would have brought in a lot of Chinese talent, which would have had a great impact on Hollywood. That said, of course, as you look at, like, say, the career of Sylvester Stallone or, you know, any of these stars who get big really young, you know, I think there would have been a period where he was on his third divorce and he decided to redo Enter the Dragon 5.
Okay.
Because the comedy he just released tanked, right? So I think he would have done, like, all of them. He would have had some misfits and we would think about him very differently because sure. he would have done a romantic comedy and it would have been terrible.
Right. And throw Mama from the Pagoda.
Exactly. Right. And then Fist of Fury 4 would have come out, right? You know, right. And so I also like to joke that he would have been, you know, he'd have had a period where no movies were getting made and he would have written a book about Jeet Kune Do philosophy and he would have been Oprah's favorite guest. So he had, and when Twitter came, he would have been all over it. He'd right. be like George Takei times 10. So I think it's I think he would have had like a real star career, ups and downs and mistakes, and he would have punched somebody in the face and that had been a story. And then, you know, he would have had the whole thing, but it would have been the whole thing as an Asian male. And that's what would have been different. And we lost that. Jackie Chan wouldn't have had to take 20 years to make it in Rush Hour. We would already had a pipeline out of Hong Kong into Hollywood in the 80s instead of waiting until the late 90s.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is something a little bit more recent, the depiction of Bruce Lee in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I know you had actually chimed in. I think you had gotten interviewed a couple times on that because that was closer to the time that Bruce Lee: A Life had come out. Obviously, all hardcore Bruce Lee fans are like, you know, why did Quentin decide to do this like total unnecessary hit job? What would you like to say to the people out there who might have seen that and think, oh, especially the younger generation, the Zoomers out there, like that is kind of what Bruce Lee was like?
So I reacted against it strongly because I love Quentin's movies and I was so excited that he was putting Bruce Lee into his film. And he got to the scene where he fights Brad Pitt. And my heart sunk. I was like, oh man, he's doing this caricature version of Bruce. And basically he has Bruce Lee as just the asshole star. And Bruce Lee could be an asshole, but he was never an asshole to the little people on set, the stunt people, the people below him. He was always a jerk to the producers or the directors or the people who were above him trying to tell him what to do. And so I thought that fundamentally missed Bruce Lee's character and painted him as a kind of blowhard. And also just the fact that the white guy basically beats up Bruce Lee or fights him to a draw. And you take the one of the very few iconic Asian macho characters and you have your white character sort of humiliate them. You know, that was just racially problematic as well. So I think what Tarantino wanted to do was, I think it was almost innocent, just like, wouldn't it be cool if to make this character, Brad Pitt's character, seem cool, what would be cool? Beating up Bruce Lee. And I don't think he even thought through all the implications of how people would react.
Yeah, his justifications were a little weird. He's like, oh no, I read it in a book once or whatever. And it's like,
yeah, that's right.
I don't know about that. Well, hey, this was a lot of fun. I just want to let everyone know, if you want to find out more about Matt Pauly, check out his website, mattpauly.com. A link for that will be in the description of today's episode. And if you're a Bruce Lee fan and you have not read Bruce Lee: A Life, what's wrong with you? Go order it right now. Pause this podcast now that it's done. Go on Amazon or whatever and order it right now. And while you're at it, order American Shaolin and Tapped Out because they're fantastic.
Yes.
And yeah, and for those of you who don't like to read, both Bruce Lee: A Life and American Shaolin are available as audiobooks. Thank you so much for joining us today, Matt. This was fantastic.
It was a joy, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Excellent. Take care. All right, so Kung Fu Genius listeners, what did you think about Matt Pauly's heatstroke hypothesis, or what did you think about any of the stuff we talked about in today's conversation? Go ahead and comment here on YouTube about anything you liked or didn't like in the episode. And if you're listening to us on audio only, well, go over to YouTube and comment over there, like right now. All right, guys, we'll see you soon.
Word is I'm a Kung Fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seekung. And I produce masters. You surpassed us. Your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the...
It already starts.
Okay, peeps, on today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius and I will be talking to Matt Pauly, the author of awesome books. We'll be talking with Matt Pauly. He is the author of Bruce Lee, A Life, written by Matt Pauly.
Yes, a Bruce Lee, A Life.
A Life.
So this idea of doing the intro after we recorded the episode isn't any better than when we did it before. No. We thought maybe it'd be more in his mind if we did the episode first and then recorded this.
It doesn't help.
No.
All right.
Okay, peeps, on today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius is making me laugh right now because he has a book in his face. Okay, peeps, on today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius and I will be talking to Matt Pauly. He is the author of Bruce Lee, A Life, the Best Cradle to the Grave biography on Bruce Lee. He's also the author of Mad Books.
What the heck, man?
I like how he reads it, and then he turns to the camera and tries to say it as fast as he can, like before it escapes his brain. It's like when you inhale helium, he knows he only has a certain amount of time before it goes out.
When helium runs out.
It's like, I gotta say this in 30 seconds. Okay. But the whole thing is like 45 seconds. He's never gonna make it.
It's gonna escape the brain. Wait, I gotta keep it in the brain. Okay, peeps. Okay, peeps, on today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius and I will be talking to Matt Pauly, the author of Bruce Lee, A Life, the Best Cradle to the Grave episode, not an episode,
biography.
Okay, peeps, on today, it's making me laugh. He's blaming you.
Oh, it's my fault.
He's making me laugh. You can't make me laugh.
Okay, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius and I will be talking with Matt Pauly, the author of PNs, the best Cradle to the Grave. Cradle to the Grave. The best Cradle to the Grave guy on the planet.
Cradle to the Grave.
What?
Unbelievable.
Why do y'all do this to me?
Okay, peeps. Yo. Okay, peeps.
It's getting worse.
Oh, no. All right.
He's also the author of America Shaolin.
Did you say America Shaolin?
It's America Shaolin.
It's... You changed it. It's American Shaolin.
You had his America.
Oh. Doesn't even make sense.
He just added the N.
Doesn't even make sense.
I know, but I thought America that was the title.
America Shaolin.
America Shaolin. He's also the author of American Shaolin. In this book, damn it.